Hello from Patricia Glynn and Storycatcher. Simple stories, simply told. This is Inspirations, conversations with people who are living big and asking the big questions. Hello again. We're exploring this month with Nanette Fleming, who has arguably done more for the well-being of South Africa's first people, the Sandbushmen, than anyone else involved in their fractured past and equally fractured present. I'm confident in saying that because I know this turf pretty well, at least the turf of the Southern Kalahari. We'll get to why in due course. It's turf that has attracted anthropologists and artists, linguists and lawyers, do-gooders like me, and government flunkies, but none have spent 30 years with them. The Kumani San community is on the southern border of the Kalahari Transfrontier Park in the Northern Cape. It's an extremely uncomfortable place in which to live and work. Very, very hot in summer, with scorpions scuttling around and fine red sand blown into every crevice of your life. The winters often lurk around 0 degrees at night, and the land is bleaker than bleak, its rigid vegetation lying in expectation of what little rain will come. And there's been so little rain of late. In fact, a drought has prevailed there for the past 8 years. 8 years. Some say more, but that's the subject of one of my potpourri features this month. For those who are tough enough to endure what the Kalahari throws at them, the rewards are deep. Stars that are close enough to touch, owls and jackals in the black night, and a simple contemplative life. Nan rented a former labourer's cottage on a farm with paraffin lamps for light, a donkey boiler for hot water, a couple of rickety shelves for her kitchenware, and a very small bedroom. But at the beginning of her journey with the Kumani San, her accommodation was way more Spartan. We'll start there. Nan arrived in the Southern Kalahari in 1999, completely by chance. She was at a loose end, and her friend, the artist Françoise Steyn, or Betta, suggested she come and stay.
And I stayed with Betta for about 2 weeks, which was very weird for me in the sense that it was summer, so you slept outside. And the concept of from the morning that you open your eyes till the evening that you close them, you are in sight of other people, was extremely, extremely weird. And it shook me a bit that I kind of didn't know, am I holding my coffee cup okay? It was very primitive. There was a bucket system. You had to wash in a bucket. So that's how I kind of arrived here. I then left, went to Cape Town, did the TEFL course, did all of that, was on my way to go abroad again. And Betta then phoned me and said, listen, there's an organization called the South African San Institute, and they are looking at development on the land, different projects. She was going to do the craft project. So she said to me, are you interested? Do you want to come and do English here? Do you want to come and be here? So at that stage in my life, didn't make a lot of sense to me. And I knew there had to be something else. And I really, really wanted to know the truth about, you know, why are we here? And is this really all there is to life? So I thought, well, if this is the opportunity, you know, these are the first people, perhaps I will find the truth here. And I came here. Betta at that stage had, with her creativity, had gone across the border, which is just 6 kilometers from here at Boksepits, saw a wonderful bus
border
between Botswana and South Africa. saw a wonderful bus, got it towed here, and she was going to live in the bus. So as I arrived, I didn't have a place, so we fixed a small grass hut for me at her place. And I was at that stage also enrolled in ABET.
What's
the adult basic education
training?
Yeah, which would be able to, you know, would help the whole process. And yeah, then the journey started.
And what a journey it proved to be. Nan had arrived in the Kalahari shortly after the Kumani had won a land claim against the government, the first successful one in our post-apartheid time. This area had been their ancestral land for hundreds of years. They wanted at least partial ownership of it. What they got was land on which they largely couldn't hunt or gather or live a traditional life in peace. The deal awarded them 25,000 hectares within the Kalahari Transfrontier Park, which had originally been the core of their territory before they were evicted to make way for tourism there, and 6 farms outside it, which totaled 45,000 hectares. They were sheep and game farms, but the whole mechanism of the claim had terrible flaws, one of which was the setting up of a so-called community property association with an elected management committee that would oversee the farms and how they were allocated and used.
It was an unprecedented land claim. It was the first of its kind in our country. So there was ignorance with that. There wasn't foresight with that. And there wasn't interest from the government. Yes, the land affairs came and so forth, but you cannot give a community, and now we've seen it in this country and we are learning the process and we know it doesn't work. You cannot not educate a community and give them a system that comes from America. And they do not understand how the system works. For years that we were here, people were saying, oh, the CPA, not realizing they are the Community Property Association, and all they need to do, they were now having management.
So what is the system from America?
The CPA, the okay. Community Property Association, is not a South African system. It was adopted from America.
So the community elects an organization to lead.
But they are the community property,
yes.
But they just need a management.
Yeah, and they thought the management
was the community
the power.
Had all the power. And nobody had given them that. Then the people elected just went through a process of misusing, taking the money, spending the money, not sticking to the management plans that there was in place. Because 50% was traditional, the game farms that were bought were traditional. The rest was for livestock. Yeah, so none of those rules were adhered to. None of the plans were adhered to, which made our life very difficult here.
There were detailed and creative plans for the farms. One or two of them were designated for tourism, for instance. But the houses on them, the beautiful houses on them, were just occupied in a hasty, haphazard, and deeply unfair process.
I worked with the English and the guides and the grandmothers. So it was all about transferring knowledge to the youth. Beta had worked with the craft project, and then Claire Barry came. She worked with the health project. There was the language that was also happening, the new language the grandmother spoke.
Although, you mean trying to preserve it?
Preserve it, mm-hmm. Yeah. So SASI had a big variety of projects that they were looking at. But in that process, there was no social work happening. For instance, people born under a tree, so they didn't have an ID. But a lot of them didn't have an ID, a lot of the elders. Because to get a South African identity document, you must at least have a clinic card and your birth was registered. You must belong to a church. So that kind of thing, that meant they weren't in the system. besides all of that, you had now brought people whose grandmothers and perhaps great-grandmothers knew each other in the park, but they had now had like a diaspora and were all over, and now the land claim looked for them everywhere, and you now all brought them to one place and thought, okay, now you must be a community. And you had a distinctive difference between the Krapers that started the land claim, worked hard for the land claim, and the people coming from other places who were not part of the, not of the same family and not originally part of the land claim. Like David Kraper used to say, the traditional leader used to say, I got on the bus and I was going to drive this process, and eventually I was thrown off the bus and other people were driving the process. Because then they opened it up to the Mier community as well, that actually was originally the busters coming from the Cape, Dirk Philander and them, and now they also had a claim in the park.
And they were coloured?
Well, yes.
Or
yes.
Nama?
No, they were coloured. No,
they were coloured, yeah. Yes, because of course Nama came from further north.
Yes.
Yes.
So that's that in a nutshell.
And a very sad nutshell at that. The first three CPAs stole and or squandered everything meant for the development of the farms and the community. So much so that a court case was brought against the Department of Land Affairs to bring these matters under control. They appointed an administrator and farm manager, but nothing much changed. And meanwhile, the farms continued to be overgrazed and ravaged. To this day, a handful of people control all the administrative bodies managing Kumani affairs, most of them not even San or Bushmen. Let me quickly address that issue. Some of the Kumani would like to be known as San and some Bushmen. The elders with whom Nan and I worked want to be known as Bushmen. There are several reasons for that, one of which is that they're proud to be of the bush with a deep knowledge of the bush.
So that's the political part of this area. Then the other part that it really hurt the elders. I remember Hugh Brody came back and Hugh Brody is the anthropologist that was part of it in the beginning. He came back and I remember we were driving from Andriesvale, which is about 60 kilometers from the park. And he said to me, why did we lose the elders? And I said to him, because the elders originally, the park was their land claim. They had to get to the park. And sand parks were very reluctant to make them co-owners of the park, because that's literally what they are. And only in 2002 did they get their land in the park. But now all the elders, that was their place. That's where they grew up. That's where they were born and where the elders are buried. And they knew the park like the palm of their hands. Jacob was in jail for assault. And Hugh Brody told me this story. He went to Jacob in jail. And he spoke to the warden and they said, yeah, he can see Jacob. And he put a map in front of Jacob with contours on the map. And he said to Jacob, this is what we need to prove.
That you lived here.
That you lived here. So I need old sites where you stayed, you know, where you had your huts and so forth. And Jacob literally counted the contours and did this and this and this and this. And when they GPS'd it and when they went back, he was out with a meter where they had made the fire, where they had done all of this.
Let us just quickly make the point that what they got in the park, was a piece of bad land far from the river. I think they called it the dummy, because they didn't get the breast.
Yes, they did get the dummy, which is 25,000 hectares, but they did get symbolic rights over the entire park, meaning they could collect their medicinal plants, they could do all of those kinds of things. So with our tracking project, we could take the elders back there. The tracking project was like the flagship where they really could get access to the park, and we negotiated and worked very well with the park management and so forth, so that we worked very hard on the relationship.
Sadly, that relationship deteriorated over the years until by the time I got to the Southern Kalahari in 2010, and for years afterwards, Sanparks management was doing everything possible to prevent the bushmen from accessing places which were historic or memorable or where they could collect their medicinal plants. Ever up for a challenge, I put on my boxing gloves and fought for permission to take the Kumani elders into the park with their children and grandchildren. We did 7 expeditions, the first of them with the famous David Kraper, traditional leader of the community who Nan referred to earlier. What a man he was, transcendent and troubled by turn, wise, funny, but also petty and downright impossible. I grew to love him despite himself, and perhaps he did me. My book about my journey with him and his family is called What David Knew, and you'll find details about it on my website. The other elders' trips were much shorter, but they nonetheless gave the children some wonderful insights into life in the park before the evictions that started in the 1930s and continued until the mid-1970s. We put their knowledge onto DVDs for the kids, which is just as well because all but 3 of those elders are now dead. The journeys were hurried and intense, and I often yearn for a more leisurely time with these wise old folk with their crinkly faces and ready wit.
Can you tell me what it was like to live with, to be with those elders?
It was, well, I can make it very and say it was magic, but it wasn't magic. It was more than that. What kept me here and what still has me here was a truth, a love, a realness of life. And yes, there were certain things that would happen, and I lived in a grass hut and I didn't have a door, and they were allowed, well, they weren't allowed, they would go in and, you know, kind of help themselves. And we had an agreement, you know, just don't take all my stuff because you need to, I get it from Uppington. But there was, I don't know, a honor, that they had your best intentions at heart. There was a innocence and a love. And I remember with the first meetings we went to, and that is why it was so easy to overwhelm them. First of all, the type of Afrikaans, because the meetings are in Afrikaans, that the people spoke wasn't quite the Afrikaans that they spoke, although they spoke Nama and Afrikaans, and they were very well versed in Afrikaans. There could be too high words that they didn't understand. But, like most indigenous people, their observation skills would be so acute. So we would have extremely important meetings with Sanparks, and you kind of had to, you know what's on the agenda and so on. And we'd walk out of the meeting so that they could have a smoke or whatever. And they would speak about the people. Did you see that one? He did this, that, and the other. I think that one we shouldn't trust. We should actually look at this one. Yeah, did you see? Oh, isn't this? So it was not with the agenda. It was the observation skills of the people. And actually, if you think about it, if I'm in extreme important negotiations with you, shouldn't we actually know each other well before I am signing away my life, my rights, and all of that?
Mm.
Literally before every meeting, we had to go and sit under a tree with the community and say, listen, remember the previous meeting, remember the bigger picture, draw it in the sand. This is where we're at. This is what we're looking for. This is how it's supposed to work. This is what we're going to ask for. Do you think this is okay? Would you want anything else? Are we doing this right? So what then happened with the elders, and this is the magic of it, that whole wonder of not being Western, and you could say that, and I don't think we can say it's Western. It's not being really honorable, because they didn't realize that people could really shy them.
Mm, mm.
People could sit in a meeting and say this and put another thing on a document and not tell you the consequences of this decision. It didn't occur to them. And that was the magic that got me. That was the beauty that got me.
The innocence.
The innocence, but the fact that I could not be in integrity because they would pick it up.
Mm.
I could not speak from my heart. So much so that after 8 years, when I left the Kalahari for a while, I couldn't handle the outside world. I didn't know how to conduct myself. So it was that magic of the elders, that love, and not minding to part with knowledge.
That's what the next thing I wanted to ask you, the knowledge that you picked up, felt knowledge. And as you said, stars and the general sort of meaning of life and their philosophy and how it worked, which means that their death, one by one, must have hurt you badly.
It was like libraries disappearing. That was what it was like. It was like libraries disappearing. Anna Swartz, one of the elders, she was a healer, a diviner, so pray, get knowledge, and then heal. And, of course, she could trance, and she could do all of that. One morning I was there, and she was sitting around the fire, and
Shrike
came and sat there. And she said, oh, you know, it looks like Roger Channels will come today. And I said, no, he's only coming in 2 weeks' time. And lo and behold, he found me and said, I'm at the lodge. I had to come a bit earlier. So it was that kind of connection. It was the magic of seeing, or the wonder of seeing it, how it all fit together, how it was all actually one. I would drive with the Land Rover, and David would say to me, don't go over the dune here. You see these and these and these bushes. You will know the Atfark will love being here. There's going to be lots of termites. So drive a bit further and then go over there.
So you don't disturb the termites?
No, so that you don't fall into, drive into Atfarkhat.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So it was that instant looking at your environment, exactly knowing from the plants right through to the termites, what kind of environment you were looking at.
And how everything,
who would be there? Would the porcupine be there? No, he wouldn't be there because there's no medicinal plants there. This one would be, no, let's go there. And it was that insight that, it was phenomenal.
So you say it was a library that was disappearing with these elders, but it was very profound friendships for you.
Yes.
The likes of which I don't think you'd ever have it again. You seem to be intimate
in
that.
Yes, because the friendship was with Oma Anna, and she used to say always, you know, when we were in the park and so on, they tried to send us to school, and I got to A. And she looked around and she said to the children, "What's the second one again?" And they said, "B." She said, "Yeah, there I left." So God and the earth taught me. That's my path. God and the earth taught me. And that was the amazingness. So now I had wonderful, wonderful friendships. And one of the amazing friendships I had was with Leona Malchas, and with her husband as well, with Jacob. Yeah, Jacob and Leona had a very stormy relationship. So Leona's escape from Jacob was to my grass hut. She was one of the most wonderful women. She was one of the most beautiful women. And she had very, very distinctive features. So much so, and I don't think just her, I think Raymond Dart in 1936 with the British Empire exhibition, he actually thought there was Mongolian influence.
Because she had those very slanting eyes.
Yes. And, you know, only later it was discovered that not. But, yeah, so she was an amazing, amazing woman. And her way of seeing life, her way of appreciating life. She could hunt. She also did medicinal plants. She had this reverence for the elders. She knew who, when the genealogy was done, she knew who was who, but she even knew who the affairs were, you know, and which child came out of that affair that everybody's just keeping quiet about. And yet she didn't judge anybody. She's also the bravest woman I know. I have never met a soul on the planet that could go through that kind of hardship of husband losing one child after the other to unnatural deaths and still remain intact. Yes, she could drink. Yes, she could get drunk. But even in her drunkenness, she used to say to me, "I might be how drunk, but I'm never false." That's true. Yeah. She was never false.
I think it's important to go through the deaths of Leona's children one by one, because only then does one get an idea of how invincible this tiny woman was. She lost her first baby because Jacob kicked her in her stomach when she was pregnant. Lollipop, the second, was mentally challenged and drowned. Jenna was stoned to death at the lodger's bottle store, and Kubus was stabbed to death. Andot died because he was a substance abuser. Then there was the tiny baby that she buried in the park and who she'd forgotten about until we took her back to that graveyard on one of my heritage mapping journeys. So that left Yuri, the youngest, Leona's pride and joy, who she hoped would get an education, do something with his life, and get a fast red car. One day, she used to say with a dreamy look in her eyes, "One day he'll take me for a ride through the Kalahari in his car." Well, that didn't happen, but Yuri did get a good education, and he's now a qualified game ranger.
Can we talk about what has happened to this fractured people over the years? The elders are all gone, barring two, maybe three, to give them guidance. Mm. And a new set of characteristics has crept in. And those characteristics are pretty nasty. Drunkenness and treachery and violence. You look as if that doesn't happen, but that's my experience of them.
There was always drinking. There was always smoking dope. But because these people knew who they were and had their roots and had their knowledge and knew where they were coming from, it wasn't dismal. It was with joy, and it was making stories, and it was all of that. Even if violence crept in and violence was there, it was still with, we could sit around the fire and say, remember when that one hit that one over the head with a piece of fire or whatever? Remember that, and we could still laugh about it and so forth. What there is now is, yes, there's still the knowledge that's coming in. Yes, there's still the felt school and transfer of the knowledge of the elders. But there is a... Remember, these elders were free. I remember Butichart saying to me, you know, come to the felt with me, and I can show you how not to be hungry. I can show you with a barking gecko, where is it, egg. I can show you how to make rain. And you will never, never need anything else and anybody again. And imagine that freedom. That no matter what the politics is, no matter what happens, you're free. You can live off the land. And we're not talking sustainable farming. We're not talking any of that. We're talking about hunter-gatherers that are on the other side of Eden, that don't farm and plant and actually have livestock, that live off what is in front of them. And to survive in that level, all of them could. All of them could be without water, living off tsamas, living off a specific root that you could dig up, living off and live healthily off it. In a semi-arid area, it says a lot. And that is not there. Yes, they do have knowledge. Yes, we're doing the felt school. Yes, they know some of the medicinal plants. But the real, that deep connectedness, you had that. We now, you have youth and people that have the fear, that are in survival mode because they are so connected to the world. And now it's SASSA money and grants for the children, and now they are negotiating a whole new jungle. So when there is drinking, it's much more violent. It's much darker.
Yeah, and if you knife somebody to death, you are living next door to his or her family for the rest of your life. Yes. Which is a different experience.
Yes.
And you have to forgive at some level.
Yes. It's most probably being in purgatory instead of doing a jail sentence and saying, oh, you know, it's over. Because you're actually in purgatory forever.
Some believe the criminality in the Kumani community will never be properly addressed because the victims protect the perpetrators. And they do that because they can't afford to have a breadwinner, for instance, in jail rather than earning a little money from herding goats or something. Or perhaps the murderer is your cousin's brother. Family loyalty dictates that you do not rat on a relative.
The Bushmen have been profoundly unkind to people who have come to help them. They have, for want of a better word, they've knifed them in the back.
Yeah.
Why is that?
I think it's the influence of people. They get completely sidetracked. They get completely drawn into things. And it's also a political thing. For my entire time that I was here, it was a thing of you are being led. you're being led by the white woman, or you're being led by this and you're being led by that. The real friends I have would say to me, but are you not leading me? So the only thing you can do is create a space where they can make an informed decision, because they do not have all the facts and do not know what can happen. You cannot really be attached to the outcome, because they can make a bad decision. It's not your decision. You can advise them about if you take this path with these people, this is can lead to this, this path can lead to that, and that path can lead to that. But what decision they make is not your decision. It's not your life. You're not living it. Because you must remember there are few pillars in the community that have a lot of information, and having information, of course, gives them power, and they love chaos. So forever, when the path is on its way and it's running, the chaos will come in. And then you have to weather that chaos. All that chaos will destroy. There was a time I lived in the community and there was literally only four people that I knew would not stab me in the back. But the rest I knew would stab me in the back. And I thought, well, if it's that four people, well, perhaps there's only two of the four people. I know where I'm standing. I know what I want to do. I know I'm honorable, you know, to hell with the rest.
Has it been, on balance, a good experience for you?
Yes, it has. Because I have left the politics. I've left the chaos people. I actually have compassion for them, because I cannot imagine what must go on in your mind if that is where you're, on what level you are there. At this stage, I'm just working mostly with the Felt School, the community school, the foundation phase, and I'm working with spirituality. Am I invested in the heart, and that we can change a generation by giving love and giving good education? Yes. Am I invested in the heart and the healing of the community, and being the connection with all the spiritual healers of other indigenous people? Yes. Am I invested in? Yes, I am. And is it nourishing and feeding my soul? Yes, it is.
And it shows in every interaction she has. The remarkable Nanette Fleming, who has a fabulous sense of humor as well, I must tell you. She has helped me with my work in the Southern Kalahari more than I can describe. Not only as a translator, because my Afrikaans is so lamentable, but as an interpreter of the deeper meaning behind what is said and gestured and symbolized in that complex place. I am fortunate to have her as a friend as well as a colleague. Till next time then, goodbye from the Story Catcher.